As you know, we've partnered with Bitbox, makers of the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. It's a secure, open source, Bitcoin-only hardware wallet with the best user experience in the industry. I personally use it to guarantee that I'll always have access to some of my Bitcoin in cold storage whenever I travel. If you want to check out a Bitbox O2, you can use the promo code HIGHHASHRATE to get 5% off your purchase or go to bitbox.swiss/HIGHHASHRATE. All one word, no spaces. Check them out.
Ah, screw it. Here we go.
What's the idea that Bitcoiners put around there? You know, scarcity in money creates abundance and everything else. And I was thinking about YouTube, you know, and it was a cool idea. I think it's a cool idea, right? Like, make all of this free, upload anything. But without any limitation, the value of everything goes down significantly. And so, you know, I think in some sense, we're creating some structure in the digital age, you know, for cinema in particular.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps.
Welcome back to High Hash Rate, episode 109. Tonight, we have on an interesting guest with whom was recommended to me through the Bitcoin film community.
The European Bitcoin Film Fest guys?
That's correct. Yes, it's Tomek. Okay, cool. Tomek introduced me to this dude.
Cool. That was a good conversation. I really liked talking to Tomek. We should get him back on here.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Well, hell yeah, Zach. How's it going, man?
Well, could I just finish my intro? All right. We have Zach on. Sorry. Yeah, Zach from Indie Hub. So I found, learned about Zach, talked to him a little bit, and he's the founder. Am I right? Founder, Zach?
Yep.
Founder of Indie Hub. IndieHub.studio. And this is just like a sort of, I looked at this thing as like a creator's paradise in a way. So I definitely want to get into tonight. But yes, as Dan asked the question, how are you doing tonight, Zach?
I'm good, man. I'm stoked to be here. I got the set all fired up, so I'm hyped, man. Ready to roll.
You got such a nice background back there, man. A nice background. How long did it take you to design that studio?
It took me a long time. It took me a while.
Anyway. All right. So what's studio or IndieHub.studio? What is this thing that you developed here and what are you founder of?
And so, then, yeah, no, go ahead.
No, I had just answer. That's how this thing goes. The one question.
This is why I cut Mike off and ask questions.
There you go.
I love it. So IndieHub.studio is a exhibition platform designed for independent filmmakers. And it's simple. The idea is simple. You upload your movie up there, and for every second that your movie's being watched, you're being paid. And if it's not being watched, you're not being paid. And the idea is simple, but I think that, you know, the downstream effects of it are profound and significant. So that's kind of the short version. It's built on top of Lightning. Although we try to be currency agnostic, we know that filmmakers, generally speaking, at the moment don't really care. We just want to make sure that they can get paid and they can get their movies watched and they can get compensated for the risk, you know, that they took making their movies.
It's kind of like Netflix for indie movies.
Yeah, you could think of it like that. Like Netflix on top of Lightning, you know, specifically for independent stuff. I mean, you know, down the line, if this thing really takes off, it's not like we're saying, oh, you're above a certain budget threshold, like you can't get on the platform. But, you know, there's just a lot of indie movies that need a market.
So you basically put your movie up, you watch, you know, whoever watches it has to pay you sats to just continue. So it's a very like micropayments we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So the very first, we're like in a very early beta right now. So the very first version of this, we don't require audience members to have a Lightning address, and we don't require them to stream sats from a wallet. Right now they can pay with a credit card. They can subscribe, you know, with Lightning. We're working on that implementation here shortly. But the idea is that they're just paying a subscription just like Netflix. And, and then we're keeping track of whatever they're watching, and we're making payouts per second. And you know, in true Lightning Bitcoiner fashion, you know, we can split that payment. We can split that revenue to anybody on the film's cap table. So you could share it with your DP or your director, or your actors, or your producers, or whoever you'd like.
What's the infrastructure behind this? Because all I hear is that, that Lightning is complicated. It's not user-friendly. It's clunky. And that, you know, you're balancing channels. And I feel like if you're doing this, where you've got, you know, potentially, you know, especially if you scale this, tons of people watching movies all at once, and you're just streaming to these creators. How complex is that? And like, how smooth has it been from your perspective, kind of like trying to make everything work behind the scenes?
It's pretty complex. I will say though that Lightning as a technology in the last 7 or 8 months has made massive strides. You know, the companies, the big LSPs, Strike, Zebedee, you know, Lightspark is doing a lot of work here. They're really making this a lot easier on companies like IndieHub to be able to just plug into Lightning and go. You know, one of the things that I didn't want to do was, you know, do all of the stuff you just said, manage liquidity and manage channels and become a payment service provider. So luckily we've been able to outsource that to one of the bigger LSPs. They've made it pretty easy, you know, but from our perspective, there's a lot more complexity that kind of even goes on top of that, just building out our CDN and stuff like that.
The strides in particular for Lightning, I mean, these, you said in the past 9 months, what are you plugging into that is so, because I'm so stupid when it comes to this crap.
Yeah, like what are the big innovations that have been really beneficial that you've been able to leverage to make this smoother?
To be honest, it's really like the big companies, Strike, Zebedee. They're the ones who are really making strides, I would say, in this. And
just their connectivity is very easy.
So yeah.
To basically plug your business into a, you know, receiving Lightning.
Right. They're building the infrastructure. And companies like this are just able to build on top of that, which is pretty cool. You know, another big developer in the space on that is like Lightspark when they're moving with Coinbase. So hopefully that's, that keeps accelerating and makes it easier for companies. I created an account. So I'm on the, like, kind of the home dashboard here, and it's a really sleek UI. Like, this is,
user
experience, UI. It's really smooth. And then, you know, it's like very familiar. Like if you're on a Netflix dashboard, and I'm recently added, right? And Mike, there's your short film right there on the homepage.
Go
right
watch
next
it.
To God,
stream me some
right next to God Bless Bitcoin. How many titles do you have total on the platform right now?
We're super, super early. I would say this is like borderline private public beta. I think we took a lot of the Bitcoin Film Fest movies, imported them over after the festival in Warsaw. So we've got maybe 20 things on there. We got music videos, some movies I did, some other stuff people have put up. We're as early as it gets here, super, super early.
And you said something back there that I had to write down because it's interesting, and I kind of wanted to dive a little into it. Was you said the downstream effects of this are significant, and I was curious what you meant by that.
So the way that I look at it, I spent my career in film and TV. I started my career as an actor. I've been working in film and TV for almost 20 years now, and the way that I look at it is that if you can create a proper marketplace where filmmakers are compensated for the risk that they're taking, you know, in an appropriate way, the downstream effects of that, you know, from an audience perspective, is you start to see actual art again. One of the things that I think about, you know, like, what's the difference between art and propaganda? And, you know, it's like, who's writing the check? Where's the money coming from? And, you know, right now the money's only coming from a handful of publicly traded companies, basically. And so, you know, we're starting to see propaganda, and publicly traded companies don't take the type of risk that artists need to take. You know, film, in my opinion, is really like right in the middle of art and commerce. It's a complex business. It's a complex business model. But it requires outsized amounts of risk. And really the problem that I think that we're solving, that I'm trying to solve, is just, you know, distributing risk back out to the people who should be taking the risk and making the decisions and reflecting back to society what they see. You know, and so if you look at artists as kind of a mirror, reflecting society back to itself, then you kind of have this feedback loop. And I feel like the feedback loop is essentially just been broken. And I think that ultimately that all comes back down to risk and reward. And that's just a long way of saying, like, the market's broken, and the information, the signal back and forth is totally broken as well. So I think the downstream effects, you kind of got two ways you can look at it. Our primary customer base are filmmakers. We're trying to create tools for independent filmmakers to take risk and earn reward. And there's a lot of things that we can do down the line, you know, if we can solve this payments issue, this very basic exhibit your project, get paid for it. If filmmakers can start to make a return, they can continue to make movies. They can continue to take risk. They can continue to produce things. I think that the biggest downsize, the biggest downstream positive effect is really just better art, more truth. You know, like, in my opinion, artists should have a reverence for the truth. And that takes a tremendous amount of risk and a tremendous amount of failure, you know, and like, movies aren't buggy whips. You know, we're not minimizing the most amount of risk to make the most amount of profit. Like, there's a certain threshold that you have to take, certain threshold of risk that you have to take. So I think that downstream you get better art, better movies, more truth, society can progress forward more, consciousness can progress forward a little more quickly, things like that.
You pointed something out to me that I just wanted to unpack a little bit, is that YouTube, you know, to produce a YouTube video is, you know, it's costless, doesn't basically cost nothing. So, and to watch it is, it costs nothing. So your platform is basically creating better art because there's like a costliness to putting it up there, and the person is not going to watch it if it's not going to get anything for it, right?
Yeah. So tangent here. It's funny you say that. I was thinking about this the other day, kind of from a Bitcoiner perspective, right? Like, What's the idea that Bitcoiners put around there? You know, scarcity and money creates abundance and everything else. And I was thinking about YouTube, you know, and it was a cool idea. I think it's a cool idea, right? Like, make all of this free, upload anything, but without any limitation, the value of everything goes down significantly. And so, you know, I think in some sense we're creating some structure in the digital age, you know, for cinema in particular. And I think some of that structure and some of that limitation will breed and create more value.
What is stopping somebody from creating just, you know, something that we would consider maybe like a low quality YouTube video, or like in using this platform? Is this, do you guys like screen for anything, or is there some sort of filter, or how do you make sure that it's not get, I mean, how do you get not get like a DDoS attacked with just worthless content uploaded on your platform to bog it down, right?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's, it does keep me up at night. I think about this a lot, you know, what's the quote? Like, I can't define porn, but I know it when I see it.
Right.
So for the short term, basically the pricing structure on it right now is kind of like our private beta structure. It was just there to have pricing. It's not really how we're going to go moving forward. Moving forward, we're going to allow filmmakers and creators to have free accounts. You know, think like IMDb, you're going to have your profile, your shot. You can be associated with any projects that are on the platform. But for anybody who actually wants to upload a movie, they're going to basically have to submit it, and we're going to screen it. We're going to have some, you know, basic requirements. It's got to feel like a movie. It's got to have some level of integrity and quality to it. And, you know, I don't, I don't like that because I don't want this to be like, you know, the Zach's opinion about good movies website.
It's permission. Yeah, it's permission.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's a gray area.
It is a gray area. It is. But I think to some extent, you know, again, we have to filter out. We have to have some standard and expectation. We got to filter out random YouTube videos. Yeah. So we'll be screening them basically.
I'm curious. You talked about some of the problems in the film industry and then just kind of like commercial distribution of film and like artists not necessarily being able to take risks or being compensated for that. Like, was there anything in particular, like experience you had in the industry that showed you that this was true? And like, what kind of risks do you think are artists not necessarily taking or not getting their, you know, not getting their content picked up? If they're, is it, cause it's, I guess my point is
like where's the risk is
or like where the risk is. Cause it seems like, you know, trying to define what types of risk being offensive or provocative right now is like, it's probably the era of the best that's ever been for that. Like you can piss people off, like it'll sell. So like what sort of risks do you see in this context that artists maybe have been not able to take without a platform like this being available?
I think the biggest risk is really time and money. You know, you got to go raise money, you got to ask people to commit a significant amount of energy, you know, potentially years out of their life, a ton of money, and the ways to make a return on that are gate kept in a way that I think is unproductive. You know, you're not going to be able to recoup. Let's say you go do a $250,000 or $300,000 movie. You know, God Bless Bitcoin is kind of a good example of this, right? They had a lot of production value, and they kind of ran into the exhibition side of things, and they just put up their hands and said, "Hell with it, we're just going to make it free. This is a nightmare." So it's really in recouping the investment that the risk is at, and that's sort of gatekept by all of these major platforms. And if you don't have the good fortune of having, you know, a Netflix or whoever say, "Hey, we're gonna pick this up, we're gonna buy it, we're gonna give you your whole budget back," you know, you're looking at aggregators who are like, "Cool, I'll give you a $10,000 MG on your $200,000 movie." It's like, it's not, you know, we'll put it up on Tubi for you. You know, like,
yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, that sounds like a significant amount of risk then.
Yeah, it's kind of all the risk. You know, it's like, it's all the risk from a financial perspective, not necessarily career risk and like pissing people off, but are you able to sustain, you know, your job and continue to produce art that is meaningful?
Now, I was never super involved in the financial side of this industry. I was more on the creative side. And so I never really understood this kind of risk that you're speaking of, but the way you describe it is like, it's quite a lot, I would say. Quite a lot.
The people who finance and kind of decide the direction of, you know, a studio or whatever, and the business decisions that go behind that, the financials, and then pretty much everybody else, like all the artists, all the actors, it seems like the gulf or the delta between like their understanding of what's good business and like what the producer and the financiers, the way they understand it is like there's a huge gulf. So like is this a good opportunity to like educate more independent artists on like the business side of filmmaking? Like, is this like a good tool that would bridge that gap?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I do. Great question. And I think that, you know, for instance, like Netflix, a significant part of the strike that recently happened had to do with a residual. I mean, there was a lot going on, but residuals were a problem. But they also, Netflix does not provide any data to filmmakers at all about anything. It's a black box.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get to see if your movie's resonating with people. You don't get to see when they stop watching it, if they keep watching it, the demographics that are responding well to it. Like, you get absolutely zero information at all. It's a take it or leave it, take the money or don't take the money. We don't really care. And they can do it. They have, you know, they have the leverage to do that. So we would like to you know, kind of break that barrier down and provide as much information to people as we possibly can, filmmakers in particular, and say like, hey, your movies are doing really well with this demographic, with this type of person, you know, in these markets, and, you know, allow them to continue to cater to those markets and those types of people. What was the second part of that? There was something else you said that was really good.
More just about like being a tool to kind of understand, get that immediate feedback of like what the direction that their vision is going. Like, is this landing? Are people picking up what I'm trying, the message that I'm trying to put across? Because like, it almost sounds like somebody could pick up your TV show because you've got a brand and like, you don't know who's watching it. You don't know how many people are watching it. Whereas this is like, you're either getting sats because people are watching, or you're getting paid because people are watching it, or you're not. And you kind of can.
Do you know where the sats are coming from on your platform?
Yeah. For right now, they're all coming from us, basically. We kind of have a pool of funds and we're shooting everything out. But
got it.
It's really coming from whoever's watching it. And I think you nailed it, Dan. Like, it really comes down to, my opinion is, you know, money is the purest form of energy. And so if somebody's watching that and they're spending their time and they're spending their money, your feedback on that is, hey, we're getting paid. You know, you have instant feedback there. You know, if people stop watching it, if they're not watching it, you're not getting paid.
You're sort of fusing time, attention, and money all in the same, you know, thing. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's true. It's like, you're not just paying up front whether you watched the movie or not. Like, it's did I catch their attention with my, you know, my trailer or my cover, but like, also did it keep their attention throughout the entire film?
Yep.
And are the artists on the platform, like, eventually, is it the plan to like, for them to get the data of their audience, and so they can learn, and like the almost like the, you know, they watched the first half hour and a lot of people dropped off, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We want to be able to offer as much information to filmmakers as possible, to give them the tools they need to succeed. That's absolutely the goal.
And do you have plans like to go out and like source and find these creators, or is it kind of a grassroots thing where you expect them to come, you know, and upload this stuff and find this themselves, or do you like load up or have the opportunity to like load up a library similar to like what you did with Film Fest movies?
It's going to be a little bit of everything. We have this cool feature. I think it's cool, where when you're uploading your cast and crew list on the platform, you can actually just input those people's email and invite them onto the platform. They can create a profile. So as you build out your cast and crew list, all of the people on that now have a profile. And so as audience members are kind of clicking around, there's an emergence to it that I really like, where they're clicking around, they find somebody's name. Oh, let's see what this guy did. This movie's cool. Oh, here's a bunch of other movies he was involved in. Click, watch. On one level, we've got filmmakers that are going to be able to invite a bunch of other filmmakers onto the platform just by uploading their movie and uploading their cast and crew list. We're definitely going to be grassroots, pounding the pavement, hitting up our own networks, hitting up our own groups of people, you know, finding as many projects that way as possible. And then, you know, film festivals, you know, there's a lot of decent movies out there that are just been kind of sitting around for 20 years that don't really have a home. We're going to attack those as much as we can. Short films, for example, like, short films don't have a market. There's no place to monetize shorts really at all. So I want to get as many shorts on this as I can. Wow. In the early days, and really, really provide some value for audience members and filmmakers. You know, there's great stuff out there that just really doesn't have, you know, it's not aggregated in the right spot. But, you know, in addition to that, you know, down the line, there's no reason that we wouldn't be able to import an entire library, say, from an aggregator. And they say, cool, we've got, you know, 200 movies or 300 movies. You know, we'll get them up that way as well. So it's definitely a multi-pronged approach. I think in an ideal world, it's really grassroots. Like, we provide enough value for filmmakers and it's a good enough platform that they're like, hey, why not? Why wouldn't I put my other movies on there and invite my buddies to this and tell him to put it on here as well?
Mike, I'm curious your thoughts on like what questions you've got specifically from the perspective, like, this is targeted towards basically you. What challenges have you faced trying to get your work out there? Like, what are the barriers that you're trying to overcome, and like, how can this be helpful?
It's a good question. Yeah, I would say that my stuff lives and dies on the internet. It just sits there, you know, and does nothing. You spend resources and time to create something, and
this
just
could be a cash flowing asset, and it's just kind of sitting in the dustbin.
Correct.
Right?
So that's what you're sort of pointing out here is like, well, this idea of having a marketplace for short films, very interesting, because there's such a heavy amount of stock of dudes just like you and me make these short films and just like spend all this time on them, and they're like, or these music videos or whatever it is, and they just sit on YouTube. Someone has to search for them or whatever, but they don't yield you anything, and YouTube just rakes in all your fucking data from it. You know?
Yep.
It's an amazing thing to offer. I mean, as far as questions, I mean, it's more about questions of what it means to be able to monetize that quickly, peer to peer like that. You know, that's huge for me. I mean,
what I think is an interesting concept is, and I don't know if this is possible already or something that like a feature that you've considered, but say you make a film and you've got a cast and crew and all the people that contributed to it, maybe there's a few dozen of them. And like, would you be able to like load up all of their Lightning addresses, and you could tailor it to like the percentage that they get over time? Like, so it, like they're getting the royalties as long as people are paying to use this, directed to each individual person through this.
Yep. That's exactly it. That's exactly the idea. And so anybody on your cap table, the platform you can go on right now, and you can just like, Michael, you could go take project and say, cool, I'm going to give, the editor or whoever, like 5%, 10%, 20%. And they essentially have the residuals on that movie. Anytime there's a wave of attention, that hits that movie again. I mean, if you look at kind of how movies go, they always have this like huge spike, this initial spike of attention when they're released, and then they kind of die out. But, you know, you've got...
They're all shit coins.
Exactly. But you've got these other waves of attention. Like, let's say you've got a short with some actor who, you know, ends up exploding in 10 years and becomes massive. All of a sudden, people are like, oh, what else has this guy done? Or what else has this woman done? And... anytime that attention goes back to that movie, like, oh, here's this short film this person did however long ago. And like, bam, you're paid again. So it just sits there, and the residual opportunity there is huge. And it kind of changes the dynamic too of budgeting. You know, like the way I see it is, back in the day you still kind of do this, but back in the day you would try to like front load with stars. You call it above the line. And so you'd get a bunch of people that would help you raise money, and you'd try to give them some equity in the project or whatever. And the above the line was sort of reserved for, you know, a particular caliber of person. But we can kind of destroy the line with this technology. Like, there doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to necessarily be about that. If you've got something that's really fantastic and you're like, hey, I'm going to give the sound guy 5%. You know, like it has the potential to lower the production budget significantly on the front end. And if it really does well, everybody does well with it. And so everybody on the project is incentivized to you know, work better, perform better.
It's promoted.
Exactly. And it's just from a bookkeeping standpoint, like, this is just not possible in the old system. It's too complex. It's too slow. There's too many middlemen. It's really hard to offer incentives to people that aren't just, hey, here's your day rate, and it's a high day rate.
And the middlemen are corrupt as hell.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, here's an example, right? So I did it. I directed and produced a documentary with a buddy of mine, Kevin, called The Ataxian. It's on IndieHub. And
go check it out for sure. It's brilliant, yeah. By the way.
It's got a great soundtrack, you know, like, and that's it. I mean, it's a good movie, but it's got a really good soundtrack. And we had, I think we got 16 or 17 songs, excluding composition, original score. And for me to go out and try to get the rights to 16 or 17 movies is like an absolute nightmare. Luckily, we had a phenomenal music supervisor on it. But basically, you have to go negotiate masters and publishing. You got two sides to every piece of music in terms of rights. And so each side could have multiple parties involved. You know, so you could be negotiating with like 10 or 20 or 30 people and to say, hey, we'll, you know, if this movie does really well, we'll give you guys a bigger cut is like, now I got to manage, you know, 120 different entities and, you know, do the bookkeeping out. Like it's kind of a non-starter. So something like Indie Hub, you could say, hey, look, bring your music on here. We'll give the band 5%. You can split, you can do the splits on the band however you want. You know, you could do it for less money up front and do a waterfall. So you could do a step deal and say, hey, if this movie ends up making over X amount of revenue, then that band's rate, you know, increases and kicks up. And it just outsources all of that bookkeeping essentially to software, which is, you know, just totally mind blowing, in my opinion.
That is pretty fucking mind blowing, for sure. I mean, the kinds of avenues that you start to think about what this is capable of is crazy. But I was curious about this. You mentioned, because I was watching this movie right before we started, and you said you were filming this documentary, The Attack Scene, and it just made me think, like, how did you come from this world documentary filmmaking, where you said you're an actor for 20 years, you've been involved in the industry, and then you're turning into this like software developing, you know, are you a software developer? It's like, how do you get there? That's what I'm trying to say, long-winded way.
So no, I'm not a developer at all. And it's you know, that's a challenge, right? Like, it's kind of like a movie, right? You can do good, fast, cheap, pick two. You got three options, but you can only do two. You know, you want, like, for the documentary, for example, we didn't have any money. I wanted it to be good. So it took us like 6 years. I'd say development's kind of similar to that. You know, you got to outsource it somewhere. You know, I'm kind of the subject matter expert for the devs, so I can just build a platform that I thought would be cool. Like, when I was 19, this is what I would have thought would have been the best. Like, I'm going to go make a movie. We got cameras, we got talent, we got energy, we got drive. Let's go just put something up and see if it works. I would say that the journey for me, you know, I acted for about 8 years, and kind of coincidentally, the last time there was a major strike was in 2008. And that strike really educated me on the business side of filmmaking. And, you know, I basically, what happened then was you kind of had a ladder back in the day. So if you were a decent actor, you know, you'd do some commercials, you'd do a co-star, you'd do a guest star, you'd do an independent movie, and then maybe you'd get into some studio features. When that strike happened, basically, the whole ladder started to go the other way. So all the big stars started to go into TV started going to commercials, and everybody got pushed down. And the pile at the bottom started to get really, really, really huge. And it just like really just lame stuff, you know, just like garbage projects basically. And I was like, I didn't come down here to, you know, go to five or six auditions a day for stuff that's just absolute nonsense. So I got pissed off. And basically just got into production that way. I said, I'm going to go start making movies that I want to make, do the stuff that I came down here to do, tell the stories that are interesting to me. Excuse me. So that kind of got me into the production world. And then I bounced around there for like another 10 years or so and really learned the business in a way that I hadn't as an artist. You know, as an actor, I was really focused on acting. I was really focused on that. I had negative respect for the business side of it, which was not good, but it was what it was. And so I kind of had to do this, like, you know, 10 or 15 year journey, learning the production side of things, learning the business side of things, learning how finance worked, learning how investment worked, learning risk from that perspective. And when I sort of stumbled in the crypto rabbit hole in 2017, the value proposition immediately made sense. I mean, within like 45 minutes, I was like, this, whatever this technology is going to be huge. You know, peer-to-peer value transfer without a middleman, like that's massive. And then that kind of led me to like, okay, well, if we can split up a payment and we can stream a payment like we stream information, well, that's just fundamentally going to change how media is consumed. And so I kind of sat on that idea for, you know, about 3 years, and then COVID hit, and, you know, I said, I've got nothing else to do. I don't have a job, so I might as well start working on this. That's kind of the quick version of how that happened. I don't know if that answered the question, but...
Answer the question.
You talk about the stories that you wanted to tell, and like, what are the stories that you're most interested in telling, and like, what... Yeah, I guess we'll start with that. Like, what's your favorite type of... Are you a documentary guy? What is
it? Do you have a thesis? Not a thesis film, but like, do you have a thesis about you, the films that you make? Like, does it come out to be the same film over and over again? Is there?
No, you know, I think later on in life, over the next 10 or 15 years, as I sort of get back into production, IndieHub will kind of start taking off and I'll start working on movies again. I think I'll be able to come up with a thesis there. But I would say what always drove me was the truth. You know, they say there's like three reasons people act, catharsis, you know, attention, and to tell the truth. And for me, it was always about being able to be on stage and speak the truth and receive the truth from somebody else, sort of this hyper realized universal truth. So I really resonate with things that that try to drill down to the deepest kind of parts of the human condition, relationship oriented stuff. When it comes to directing, the Ataxian, I thought this really exemplified it, which was you've got human beings in an incredibly difficult situation. And so I like to see when human beings are just squished in terms of stress, so that their deeper, truest character is revealed. I really like to see who people are when things are the most difficult and the most challenging, and it really, really reveals the, you know, kind of the deepest core part of them. I'm really interested in that kind of stuff.
This brings me to my next question, which is, what the heck is the Ataxian project? What was that?
So the Ataxian is a documentary about this guy named Kyle Bryant and Sean Baumstark. These two guys have an incredibly rare disease. It's called Friedreich's ataxia. Ataxia is kind of a general word for discoordination. So there's dozens of different kinds of ataxia. So the version that they have is, it's tragic. There's no treatment, there's no cure. It's progressive, it's degenerative, it's, neurological. And basically what happens is, you start to lose your ability to coordinate your body in physical space. Your mind is completely unaffected. You basically get confined to a wheelchair and you go blind and die of a heart attack. And the earlier you're diagnosed, the earlier you're probably going to pass. So, you know, if you're diagnosed with Friedreich's ataxia at 5 or 6 or 7, you might not live past 17 or 18 or 19. If you're diagnosed later in life, then you're probably going to survive a little bit longer. So the movie follows these two guys, Sean and Kyle, who have Friedreich's ataxia, and they decide that they're going to take place in the world's toughest bicycle race. So there's a bicycle race called the Race Across America, and it is the most grueling bicycle race in the world. You go from Oceanside to Annapolis. That's over 3,000 miles, and you have to complete the race in 9 days continuously. There is no timer. You don't get to pause and stop. You have to go across the entire country in 9 days or less to be considered a qualifier. So we followed them across the country, and we didn't really know who they were at the time. We got quite close to them, obviously, throughout production, but we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if they were going to make it. We didn't know if they were going to get hurt. I mean, people die on this race. They get hit by cars. You know, it's a dangerous activity. So, you know, it was, you know, Kyle he was on a recumbent tricycle. Sean was a little less progressed in the disorder, so he actually rode a bike standing up. But, you know, they have trouble walking. It's also an energy deprivation disease. So, you know, your energy is significantly affected. So basically these guys said, you know, fuck this. We're going to go live our life to the absolute fullest, and we're going to put ourselves in the most intense situation that we possibly can. And that's really the movie. We followed them across the country.
I'm curious, you talk about wanting to see what people are really made of, like when they're in the really grueling situations. And by following people and filming and watching people in these situations, like, are there any specific characteristics or like life philosophies that these people have in common when they're really succeeding or having positive outcomes as a result of like some of these experiences that are really testing their will and testing their character?
Like, are you asking like kind of consistent traits that I've noticed?
Yeah, right. Like it's something those people have in common that makes them thrive in these situations, if that's what they're kind of doing in them.
I would say, trying to boil it down, I would say it's that they have they're connected to a higher order, either that's purpose or God, you know, some sense of humility, some sense of their place in the world, like a lack of arrogance. You know, and it's counterintuitive, right? Because you've got this, like, I'm going to go do this insane thing that I have no business doing at all. So on one level, there's some form of arrogance, but underneath that is this like really soft, humble underbelly. That I think is really a really interesting combo. So I would say that it's that they're not the top of their own universe. You know, they have something they're oriented towards that is much more meaningful than their circumstance.
I want to just ask one question about the ataxia. One more question.
And that, of course.
That is, I'm curious about, I mean, that sounds like an amazing trip, you know, a very difficult shoot. I'm curious about the challenges on that shoot and what a day was like, or what you were going through. What's the crew size? You know, what are you shooting on? What are the details?
Man, the first feature I really get sink my teeth into, I hope will be a buddy comedy road trip about us trying to make this movie, because it was preposterous. we really had no business doing it from a logistical perspective. We were young at the time; we were in our early 20s, and you know, kind of similar to the answer to the question I gave you, Dan, was like we were oriented towards this story. You know, the story was more important than our well-being and our ability to, you know, we had no regard for how difficult it would be at all. And it's the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. And it's not even close. The movie basically fell apart, probably 6 or 7 or 8 times, where literally like back at the wall, we're just giving up. I'll give you one example. So the race is a relay, and you gotta imagine that the logistics of this are really complex. The teams themselves, they have multiple RVs, they have support vehicles, they have a whole group of people who are feeding them, driving them, washing them, clothing them, repairing their bicycles. Giving them, you know, everything that you would need on this race. You have a whole team of people who are doing it. So we kind of had to be that for ourselves while not getting in the way of, or doing our best to not get in the way of the race itself. And the race has some reasonably strict rules about media vans and, you know, people who are involved in shooting stuff. So we had no money. We shot this all on basically 7Ds at the time. Now, if we were shooting it today, like, the equipment, the codecs, like everything is just like so much better. So we were shooting this on cameras that really couldn't even roll for longer than 12 minutes without overheating. You know,
or
the batteries
out,
were like,
you know? They would just clip out, right?
Exactly. They would just turn off.
Yeah. Just clip
like,
out.
Nope.
Clip's done.
Anyway. So yeah, We had no money, and we had to rent an RV. Now, every RV basically on the West Coast gets rented out, you know, like the Cruise America RVs and all these things. Like, they're all rented out. They're all completely booked for like months in advance for this race. All of these people are down in Oceanside. They have all of the equipment. And we tried to get our van like too late. Couldn't find one literally anywhere within like four states. One of us ends up on Craigslist and we find this.
I like where this story is going.
We find this fucking piece of shit. This thing was like 38 feet long. You needed a different class license to drive it, which none of us had. This random dude. I mean, this thing was huge. It was built in, it was a 1988, you know, whatever the hell. Just an ungodly monstrosity. So this guy, for whatever reason, is renting out this van on Craigslist for like $2,500. And we're like, okay, sounds great. He was kind of nearby where we were at in LA at the time. And the guy who rented it to us was this like Saudi dude who owned like 500 gas stations. And like the dude was like, unbelievably rich. Like, I absolutely no idea why the guy didn't just light this RV on fire. Like, what the fuck does this guy care about $2,500? He doesn't. Like, this is ludicrous. So we go and we get this RV, and this thing is just absolutely massive. It literally had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It had 10 wheels, 10 tires. And the first thing we noticed when we rented is like most of the tires are cracking. And we're like, okay, this is going to be a problem. But we have to leave. Like, literally the next day we have to be down in San Diego. So we have all this gear. We have everything packed up. I'm talking with the guy who's renting it to us. And he's like, yeah, no problem. You know, we'll send you money for the tires. Like, just take care of it. No big deal. So we go down, and for about 2 days we're shooting prep in Oceanside and we're shooting B-roll, and he just doesn't respond to me at all about the tires. Like, he's gone, like not responding to phone calls at all. And the race, you have to register all the vehicles, and all the vehicles have to pass these safety inspections. And so, like, the tires have to be in good shape, all the emergency flashers have to work, like, you know, basic stuff, but like it needs to work. So I'm panicking for like a day or whatever, trying to find 10 of these very specific tires that are cracked. I find them, you know, they cost me like $2,000. So we're already like, you know, now we're like way over on the RV budget. I get those overnighted to me from some random dude further down in San Diego. Like, you know, God bless that guy. He like totally delivered on these tires. So the RV is like in this crazy, you know, lift this thing is not like your normal tire situation, right? Like, to even get these things off is like its own nightmare. So we get the tires taken care of. That's totally fine. And then we realize like the emergency flashers don't work. The windshield wipers basically don't work. Like, none of the toilets work. The water doesn't work. The AC stops working. So we're going through this little inspection and they're like, you know, they're basically going to fail us. We're like, we're going to totally fail this. Like, we're done. It's not happening. And so the way emergency flashers work is there's like this little device you buy and you plug into the cord. It's kind of like under the dashboard. It's like this little circular thing. And it basically like modulates the signal to create the flash. So I tried to go find one of these things, but of course none of those like exist at all. So while they're running this inspection, I'm hiding under the dashboard while somebody else is in the seat, like turning the engine on and whatnot. And I'm literally just pressing the emergency flasher button, like trying to do it at like an appropriate cadence. So we get the tires worked. That's fine. The flasher thing, a total disaster. And then, you know, there's a bunch of other stuff that's a disaster, but we get to the night before everybody's supposed to actually leave and the RV's dead. It won't turn on. It's completely just bricked in this, you know, shitty hotel parking lot. And I'm talking 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. I'm trying to figure out a way to get this to work. We're bugging the team now, and we've got like the team mechanics are working on this, and they're super irritated with us because this monstrosity's in the way, and they've got to focus on prep, and now they're just getting pissed at us, and I'm just begging people like, please help us start this RV. So I can't find anything, and literally I'm in a hotel room with my buddy, and I do that like movie scene where I just like hit the wall with my back and I slide down the wall, and I'm basically about to start crying, and I'm like, it's over, like the whole thing's done. We've been prepping for 6 months. We've already got a bunch of shoots.
Wow.
And
just
I make one.
He's been prepping too. The writer, he's been prepping that entire time too.
Oh yeah, they've all been prepping for over a year.
So it's like, this is it. It's now or never, right?
Which now or never.
Okay.
Now or never. It's not happening. It's a big deal. And this is early on. So like, you know, Google Maps, like cell phones, like data, like that was all much more challenging. Signal was a problem everywhere. So just finding a way to call different places was a nightmare. Getting internet was a nightmare. And so I make this last ditch call to, there's this RV services, 24-hour RV repair in Temecula. And so this guy's probably like 2.5 hours away. And I call this dude at midnight. Everybody's trying to sleep. They have to leave at like 6 a.m. or whatever. The race starts. I call this guy and I'm just groveling. I'm just begging. You know, this guy answers the phone. It's midnight. He's like, oh, he's like totally asleep. I'm like, 24-hour RV repair. Do you do that? he's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, bro, listen, I'm doing this documentary. We're shooting these guys who have this crazy disease. It's a really good project. We're in this thing called the Race Across America. We got to go to Annapolis like tomorrow. It's going to be this crazy race. And the guy goes, oh, Ram? Race Across America? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh, I finished that as a solo rider like 3 years ago. Fuck yeah, I'm in. He's down. So this dude hops in his car. He's all about it now because, you know, it's this bicycle race. And he gets down there at whatever, like 2 a.m. or whatever time it was. He starts going to town on this RV. This guy's like RV expert. And after however long, about an hour, you know, he's not looking too happy either. And I'm like just like biting my nails looking at him. And he's like huffing and puffing and he's not looking too stoked about it. He finally gets the thing turned on. And he comes over to me and he goes, all right, man, I got some good news and I got some bad news. Good news is I got it turned on. The bad news is you can never turn this RV off ever again.
It's like speed.
I'm like, exactly. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, literally, dude, if you ever turn this off ever again, it's never starting. Like it's bricked. And I was like, so we have to keep this on for the next 3 weeks? And he's like, yeah. I was like, what? So we keep this RV on for the next, all the way across the United States. We never turn it off. We don't turn it off to fill it up with gas. We don't turn it off to do anything.
It's like Survivor when they get like a little fire going and they cannot let the fire go out for the next 40 days. They got to protect it.
Yep, exactly. And so we get it all the way across the country. And you know, at this point I've had multiple like run-ins with this guy who rented me the RV. And like, at this point I'm kind of scared for my life. This guy's like super sketchy. And we get to Annapolis, they have to keep it on cause we still have a crew that has to drive back. They got to drive back to California in this RV to return it after they've already shot the race. Most of my friends are on this shoot. They all hate me. They hate each other. They went through storms in the like crazy rainstorms. All the water started leaking through the lights in the RV. Oh, they had to remove all the hard drives. The AC didn't work. The back brakes locked up and lit on fire. And so finally, so we get
what's the crew size, by the way? I forgot.
Let's see. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We probably only had like 6 or 7 guys on this. So it's like,
wow. Okay. All right. So you're going, and water's leaking all over the place on these 7 guys.
Yeah.
And they all hate each other.
Exactly. And they're all overheating because the AC doesn't work. And like, you know, they're trying to get sleep in the bed. But like when you're in a 38-foot RV or whatever, like you go over one bump and you're just like launched in the air super hard. One of my friends, he's over it. He's like, get me a plane ticket out of here. I'm not driving back. I'm like, all right, no problem. Sorry. And they get it back to Oklahoma. And the RV finally just full-on dies in Oklahoma.
Rest like,
that's
in place.
It. It's over. We get it towed to this place. And I call this guy and I say, look, your fucking RV is in Oklahoma. Like, figure it out. I don't give a shit anymore. Fuck off. You know, that's one. That's like one. That's just one. That's just the RV. You know, that's not even, you know, all of our own shenanigans.
What an amazing story though. That RV is like, this dude just like came in with this last minute RV, and it was the RV was meant to die on that that trip, right? That's a godsend right there.
All I can think about is just like, if at least from my perspective, people don't appreciate how much work and energy and misery and suffering goes into making a movie, right? They take so much for granted.
One other thing on kind of the equipment. So we get, you know, we end up somewhere around 400 hours of footage for this movie. And again, we're all on, these are all on Canon 7Ds. Like, this is a shit codec. I'm not exaggerating, dude. It took me 6 months.
Yeah, that's why it took
24 hours a day just to transcode it so we could edit it. That's just the transcoding. Like, that's not, like back in the day, you couldn't just pull in a 7D footage and edit it. It was too compressed. The codec was too, you know, we had to basically transcode everything to ProRes. It took me 6 months just to do the transcoding, like day and night, 24 hours a day.
Joe, how do you fucking log that much footage, man? That is 6 months later or 6 weeks later or whatever it is. That's it, 6 months, you said.
Yeah, it was nuts. It was nuts. It was totally nuts. Wow.
Well, man, I could go into a ton of other things. Dan, what do you got?
I got time, so no rush on mine. Go ahead, Mike. This is your domain.
You know what? I kind of want to head back to Indie Hub again. I'm wondering where everything lives. Is this does it live on some sort of server?
Cloud.
Does it live in the cloud? Where is it?
So everything is in the cloud, as they say, which basically is just somebody else's server. So it's all on our servers. We have a pretty sophisticated content delivery network organized and built out. So it's basically on all of our servers. We have a bunch of different kind of custom and automated tools that we've built out to try to deliver the specific stuff that we think filmmakers will need from that perspective.
I guess this really isn't that world, but do you think there would even be a demand for some sort of rating system for these movies? Like, if you're coming in like, oh, I don't want to watch a rated R movie, I don't think you'd even call it rated R. I think that's trademarked, but like, is there anything like that? Or is that not really, the audience isn't really looking for rating systems like that?
We don't have anything built out like that yet, but it's definitely on our roadmap. And I think it's a really good question. Like,
that's a tough one too, though. It's like, you're kind of making this judgment about values on these movies.
Yep, exactly.
Well, if it comes with a set of, you know, maybe some descriptions and people talk about it and enough people are rating
for
it,
sure.
Then, you know, that could be more democratized version of the rating system, I guess. But.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I have this vision of being able to build out our own feedback system. You know, one of the things that I don't think anyone has really nailed yet is the browsing experience. You know, like, they're all terrible. You know, I can sit around and like scroll through Netflix for 40 minutes and then just give up. You know, like, why is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
Too many choices.
Sometimes that's the movie experience, is just the scrolling itself.
Exactly.
How terrible.
Yeah, we got rid of cables, so now instead of flipping through the channels, you're just scrolling through, you know.
Exactly. And I think that this is where I'm at with it now, and this will evolve, and we're open to feedback on this. I really want to nail this over time. But I think that there's an emergence that doesn't exist on platforms right now. You guys see that movie, The Last Blockbuster?
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, kind of jumped off the rails for a little bit, but there were a couple little gems in there. And one of the things I took from it was that part of the experience was like that you had to put work into kind of stumbling across and discovering movies back in the day. You know, like you had to negotiate with your mom or your girlfriend or your parents or your siblings or whatever. And like everybody, like there was a fair amount of work that went into this decision you made before you went home and really committed like 2 hours. And I think that emergence is missing from most of the platforms. You're just spoon-fed stuff, and I don't think people really want to be spoon-fed stuff. And, like, you know, fuck your algorithm anyway. Like, I don't even know what's up with the algorithm. So, you know, I want to try to combine both of those where people have the ability to stumble across things that they feel like they discovered on their own rather than being force-fed. And I think a lot of that has to do with filmmaker profiles and being able to communicate with and have a relationship with the artists. So we want to have kind of a combo. I mean, you have to have some kind of algorithm just to sift through stuff and decide. But we really want to get to a point where audience members are putting a little more work in and accidentally finding things that they end up making decisions about. I think there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah, and being like you said, following the filmmakers themselves, or almost like seeing their peers of like if you could almost get like share that data of like who's watching what, people that want that public, like, oh, this guy really knows good movies, and this is what he's been this is what he's been spending his money on.
Yes, nailed it with that one. You know, one of the hopes that I have for the platform is that let's see, is this my why is that not charging? That's also, super dumb.
You can also reverse that relationship and get the person who's watching paid at the same time. Like, you know what I mean? You can maybe if ads come into the play or something, I don't know. There's other.
Or somebody recommends a movie and they get part, like, they get 1% of the split or something, almost, you know, something like that.
Bingo. You can get influencers involved in that way and say, hey, like, this movie was fantastic. Somebody's got a million followers on whatever account. Hey, this movie changed my life. Go check it out. And bam, all of a sudden you can embed them into the split.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really hope happens is, you know, we all had, when we were younger, right? We all had that friend, maybe you guys were this friend, who had like impeccable taste in music. And so they'd be like dumpster diving CDs. And they'd be like, you know, hey, listen to this, listen to these guys, listen to this. And sure shit, you know, 5 years later or whatever, all the bands they recommended just ended up becoming massive. So you have this like kind of like character archetype, these people who are really good at, they have really good taste, they're really good at discovering talent. And I'm really hoping that we find a good role in Indie Hub for people like that, who are really good at discovering talent 100%. And can make recommendations on really right. talented people. And kind of have a stake in the careers of people, you know, like this actor is fantastic. This director is fantastic. Like, you guys have to follow this person.
Yeah.
They're doing fantastic work. So,
right. It's like everybody, I mean, at least I know personally, I like to be the person that finds that really good meme that hasn't gone viral quite yet, that nobody else has seen in their feed. Nobody has got a text to them, or the recommend that movie or recommend that new series. And then you get the text from your friends, like, and they're telling you what season they're in. And you're like, oh, this is going to happen. Like, there's something magical, you could almost say, about being able to find that stuff and then show it to other people. And I think that's something that, like you said, Netflix doesn't have, where it's you find something and you can be that person that in your community that kind of brings awareness to it, and people trust you for your taste.
Exactly. And reviews too. Like, you could imagine a scenario where people get really, really good at writing up reviews, and they could get tipped for that. They could get compensated for that. People go, man, this review is dope. I'm going to zap you, sure. You know, 1,000 sats or whatever.
It seems like quite the infrastructure, but yeah, that sounds like totally awesome to have. Something happens.
Yeah. You kind of touched on this a little bit earlier when you were talking about how you got into Bitcoin, and like when you found crypto in 2017, it was like this exchange of money for information or for data. It's like the more
as peer to peer aspect,
And then as we go, it's like more and more people are spending their time on the internet, scrolling, watching something, whatever, on their phone or on their TV. And it's like that's what we're doing. We're using data, and it's like art and artists are kind of always on this frontier of making art that kind of changes people's perspectives on the world, on technology. And it's like kind of starts with like streaming films. But then you can almost see where this leads to a time where like anytime you want to access the internet or any data from somebody else's server, instead of having an internet subscription, you're connected to the network or through 5G or whatever, and you're just paying for data, streaming almost everything. on like an on-demand basis. It's like I'm not paying $100 a month for internet. I just stream, you know, micropayments when I need to access it. And then you create this market where it's prices go up, prices go down, and then it really starts to kind of like tune what people, how people spend their money and their time when most of that is consuming data.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that like the inverse of that is true with ads. You know, they're making things free, but they're not really free because they're just sucking your attention. And the incentives are skewed. They're backwards, you know. If people really value their time a little bit more and their attention, and we can figure out a way to, you know, teleport this person's time and energy to this other person in an exchange, right? Then we've got a much better ecosystem, a much better market. And I think everybody wins in that situation for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's very obvious, I guess, now that you've said it, but I never thought about it before, where it's like it's anything that's free that comes with ads, it's not free. You are paying with your time.
Yeah.
All that extra time you have to watch that stuff.
Yeah. And time is money. So you're still paying for
it. Right. Yep. Exactly. And you know, in kind of a negative way, it's like, hey, if this movie sucks, I'm just going to stop watching it. And they're not going to get paid for it.
Well, hey, if you're a vendor on the street, you know, I think we had another guest on here, Captain Sid, said this. If you're a vendor on the street in Thailand and your food sucks, people are just not going to go to you.
Doesn't matter how much you cooked, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. You're going to go out of business. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I think we're hitting that right now with the way movies are being produced and the content that's out there. People are, they're not responding to it. You know, everybody knows that most of the stuff sucks, but there's not a decent alternative. There's no way to support people that you want to support. You know, Patreon is like, okay, but you know, I'm not going to give $50 a month to this random podcast or whatever. Like, that's not the most viable situation. So let's just split it up, man. Split it up into seconds.
Man, I have to say, Zach, I have tons of more stuff to pick your brain about, but I think we're going to come up on time here, and I want to be respectful for everyone's time. So I think if you can just sort of tell us a little bit, you know, where to find you, the project, maybe some other projects you're working on.
Yeah, you said that you're in the early beta. Like, what is the timeline here to kind of where people can, I mean, I've already got an account and I can already watch stuff, but what's the plan going forward?
So we're going to be focused primarily on getting and onboarding filmmakers. So any Bitcoin filmmakers out there, or if you know any Bitcoin filmmakers or just any regular filmmakers who have projects that are lying around, send them to IndieHub, send them my way. Let's get them on there. Let's get them paid. I would say for the, like I said, next 6 to 12 months, we're really going to be focusing on that aspect of it, building out our library. And, you know, after that, we're probably going to make a more concerted effort to start marketing and advertising for the audience side of things. And pulling in, you know, that culture of people who really want to support the people that they're watching. So, you know, very, very early days, you know, we're looking at a 5 to 7 year, you know, time frame before we feel like we're really going to be in stride. I'm on Noster, Zach at indiehub.xyz. It's my Nippo 5. Not saying the MPubs out here. IndieHub at IndieHub.studio is also on Noster. Website IndieHub.studio. Reach out, hit us up. We're here. We'll get you guys set up for sure.
And the MPubs for that will be in the show notes. And I got to comment one more time. For such an early project, like the platform itself looks fantastic. It looks really sleek. It looks badass, like your podcast studio background there. Like, it's very sharp. So it's definitely worth checking out. I did have one more question because I forgot to get to it. So you can take your time to answer it if you have a lot of thoughts, if not. But there's a lot of people that speculate and they're using AI, right? And they're talking about AI's potential to disrupt filmmaking, replace artists in creating films and movies. What is your perspective on that? Because it seems like I use AI pretty frequently, and it's just so far away from being able to make any good content where it's not being generated by an artist already.
It's a great question. It's a fantastic question. I think it's probably going to be one of the more important questions of our times. I am of the opinion that that the AI, kind of going back to 2008, right? Like everybody was worried that the industry was going to collapse, and it did for different reasons. But what happened was, when everybody got used to these tools, right? Like the internet was out there, cameras were much cheaper, production was much cheaper to do. Everybody was worried that it was going to be destroyed. But what actually happened is the industry exploded. Way more stuff going on. And I think that AI will be incredible tools for filmmakers to achieve their goals. But I do not think that AI is going to be creating content that people are going to resonate with. I don't think that there is a connection to a higher power, to God, to source, however you want to say it. I just don't think that they're going to have that connection. They're not going to be able to predict out into that like boundary of order and chaos that artists really live in when they're bringing something in. You know, like the way I look at it is whenever I was doing my best work, I could never really take responsibility for it. I was channeling something. And in my opinion, the best artists are really good at getting themselves out of the way and becoming a channel for whatever that is that needs to come forth into consciousness. So I don't think that AI, I don't think that we have a problem with that. I also have a market-based opinion on that, right? Like the more AI content that's out there, it's a supply-demand issue. If there's a massive supply and no demand, it has no value. And so I don't think that people are going to be sitting around, you know, consuming AI movies. A, there's going to be too many of them. B, they're going to be, you know, kind of garbage. So I think that it actually is going to kind of create a renaissance back towards people and their connection to source and give artists the ability to really do their job more so than they were able to do it from a logistics perspective. Having an AI like create a scene and, you know, create a human to human connection. Like there's so much we're talking billions of years of evolution, right? The way I say that is we've got billions of years of an unfathomable amount of energy that has coalesced into a human being having an honest moment that's captured on a camera. Like the AI is not going to be able to reproduce that. I don't think.
They'll only be able to copy it. That's it.
Exactly. And it's a copy and it's just reproducing something that already exists. But that's not what great artists do. Like right. I say, great artists pull that thing from the edge of chaos and order. So I actually think that it's going to, I think that we're on the cusp of an explosion here. And I think that the next 15 years are going to be bonkers as far as what artists are going to be able to do with this technology. I don't think it's going to replace. I think it's going to help.
That's a good perspective. I agree. I think that we already have enough derivative art out there, and it just gets getting more watered down, right? So it's this AI explosion is going to add to that, but it's going to debase the platforms, content stuff even more. So.
It will make the movies that are truly great even better,
right? And cheaper to make for, you know, if you have access to those tools, for sure.
Yeah,
cool, awesome,
cool. Yeah, thanks Zach for coming on there.
Indie Hub, I-N-D-E-E Hub dot, or excuse me, dot studio.
Yeah,
Indie Hub dot studio.
Yep, absolutely. You guys, I really appreciate you bringing me on. Go check out Michael's movie, Project. It's on Indie Hub. It's fantastic. It's my favorite thing out there right now, I especially if you're a filmmaker.
Check out the attacks.
I'm going to watch both of them. But Mike's is short, so if you're broke, you can still afford it.
Yep, I've watched it four times.
We need to bring this, caravan story to life. So you have to check out the attacks, and we got to get this thing going. Anyway,
for sure.
Cool, guys. I'll cut it. Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate Podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked 80 IQ plebs, reach out to us at hello at highhashrate.com, or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!